Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to use overheads. Now, everything I say today will be based on joint work with Robert Jarrow of Cornell and Umut Chetin, who was of Cornell and is now in Vienna, and next year will be in the London School of Economics. So he was a PhD student. Okay, of Jarrow's. So before I start in liquidity risk, I thought I would just kind of review the financial model that we are going to extend. I think probably everybody knows this to some extent. The basic idea is that we have a risky asset price, a savings account. A is the amount of the amount of shares, say we have, let's call it a stock, the amount of shares we have in a stock, and B is the amount of bond we have. We will generally assume that the interest rate is zero, so RT is going to be constant and equal to one. That's not, you know, that assumption can easily be removed by a change in numerator. And we will assume that a strategy is AB. We will assume it's self-financing, which means that the value we have at time T is equal to what we started with, plus the cumulative gain or loss, gain can be positive or negative, of our strategy. So no money comes in and out. And we have the usual definition of arbitrage, which is that you start with zero, you end with something non-negative, but there's a positive probability that it's positive, however small, then that's an arbitrage opportunity. And for the purposes of the model, we assume that they don't exist. Which basically is kind of a depressing assumption, because what it means is if they exist, the market is so quick to jump on the fool that's offering it that it disappears almost as fast as one of those elementary particles that, you know, disappear as soon as they're created. So we just assume they're not there. Okay, and then we change to, if you're a mathematician, we change to an equivalent martingale measure, and if you work in a business school, we change to a risk-neutral measure. It doesn't really matter. It's the same. And so we will call a model good if we can change our semi-martingale into a martingale or local martingale under this risk-neutral measure. And, of course, we assume that our semi-martingale is good. Okay. So these are all the standard classical assumptions, which now I probably don't have to justify to this audience why we need to study liquidity risk, but I'm used to giving this talk. I often give this talk to mathematicians who don't know much economics, and so this is a plot. I'm very proud of this plot. It's one of these plots that you can only be proud of if you almost made it yourself. And what I mean by that is I spent 6 hours talking with somebody who makes plots, and so therefore I consider that I made this plot. But at any rate, this is a plot of tick data for one day of trading with Cisco. And just to prove that there are large traders, this is the price, which is around $60 a share. And this was 1998, when the dollar was actually worth something, the American dollar. And this is the time of day. So this graph here represents kind of like a Brownian motion. And the vertical axis is the size of the trade, so which is redundant because I've also color-coded it. So the blue diamonds, which are hard to see because they're kind of obscured by all the bigger, taller buildings here, are trades of size between 0 and 1,000 shares. And the green is trades between 1,000 and 50,000, and the red is trades between 50,000 and 150,000. And you see there's lots of quite large trades. And the larger trades force the, well, if these are buyer-initiated trades, of course, for every trade there's a buyer and a seller. So what we're talking about is the trades that come about because they're initiated by the buyers. The buyer-initiated trades will tend to force the price up, and the seller-initiated trades will tend to force the price down. And there's an algorithm called the Lee and Reddy algorithm, which was developed at Cornell. And the way we tell that these are buyer-initiated trades that are forcing the price up is, if the price was forced up, we call them buyer-initiated. So it's kind of a circular logic, but I mean, we're used to this, right? It's economics. So, but this is the standard way to decide whether it's buyer or seller initiated. And the point is that the point I'm trying to make here is that Cisco is a highly, highly liquid stock. It has to be, because the chief executive officer is paid like $150 million a year, even when Cisco's losing $1 billion a year. And that's off the books, he's paid, because he's paid in stock options, which means they have to water down the stock. And if you're going to water down the stock to that extent, you have to have a lot of shares, right? So Cisco is a highly liquid stock, and yet it looks like the large trades are forcing the price up. And if this is unconvincing, I have another example, and two examples should be convincing, right? This is a random day. Random because it's the day I had data for IBM, which is so giant. I mean, here we're talking 100, price in the hundreds, and trade size goes up to 250,000 shares. So the old paradigm of the 1950s, where there were lots and lots of little traders, IID, coming together and doing all their little actions, and in combination, central limit theorem applies, and we have a normal displacement. Doesn't really apply when you have huge trades. In fact, there are no red trades here because I had to truncate them. I didn't include the red trades because instead I did four colors, blue, green, yellow, and red. And I just left off the red trades because otherwise all you would see is the red trades pretty much because they would just overwhelm the picture. But IBM, of course, is also a highly liquid stock. And once again, you see the same type of phenomenon. Now, let me talk about the problems with the standard theory that I reviewed very briefly. And to do that, I'll talk about the five kinds of risks that economists have. One is the market risk, which is the standard thing that we study, price fluctuations and in the market. A third is credit risk, and we just heard a very very fascinating talk about credit risk, right? Default probabilities and recovery rates. And the subject of my talk today is liquidity risk, which is price fluctuations due to supply and demand imbalances. So, for example, when you take the S&P 500, they're always changing the stocks in the S&P 500, right? They have to because, Enron goes out of business, it needs to be replaced, right? Or drops out of site, or one company buys another company, then it's the S&P 499, right? So they need a 500th stock. So or just the company really is just not really what it used to be anymore, and so they drop it. So there's a lot of reasons. They replace about 30 stocks in the S&P 500 each year. And when a stock is put in the S&P 500, on average, its price per share goes up 8%. Simply because of liquidity, because there aren't enough, nobody wants to sell it because it just joined the S&P 500, so it's better. And all of these S&P 500 linked indexes that everyone buys as instant diversification, mindless diversification, which is what we all want, they have to buy it. I mean, they don't have to buy it that day. They have a certain limited period when they have to buy it, but by rule, they have to buy it. So this is just showing you that there and liquidity, I've talked with David Blitzer in some detail about this, and he helps choose which stocks replace the stocks when they add a new stock to the S&P 500. And liquidity is a major consideration. Like, they would love to put, for example, Berkshire Hathaway in the S&P 500, but they can't because it's like highly illiquid. So that's Warren Buffett's company, of course. All right, so now there are two other risks that generally are not that, well, that we're not going to talk about. One is model risk, which is the risk you take if your model is wrong. You know, you're using the Black-Scholes model and there's heavy tails and you're ignoring that fact. Or operational risk, which is the risk that you're using data from a company which is fraudulent, run by criminals, which describes most of the S&P 500, I think. But at any rate, or it's run by incompetent people or whatever. So we're not going to talk about these risks. There are some mathematical tools you can use to study them, but we're going to talk about today about liquidity risk, which is generally goes hand in hand with the other three risks. And these are kind of like paradigm shifts. So so how are we going to change the standard model? Well, two important changes is that once you start, the standard model assumes that companies are perfectly liquid, that any time you want to make a trade, there is instantly somebody there ready to buy or sell what you want to sell or buy, right? But actually, so like if you call up your broker and you say, what am I worth today, like I do, so he adds up the prices of all the stocks currently there and multiplies by the number of shares and tells me I'm worth $150, then that is kind of not a correct procedure, because if I were very rich and I said, okay, hey, I'm worth, my portfolio with just with you is worth $120 million, hey, all right, sell, liquidate. I'm going to buy one of those new Porsches. I need all of my $120 million. All right, so then what happens is he does that, and you end up with $100 million. Because you followed an incredibly stupid strategy to get rid of your portfolio, which is just sell everything now. Right? Especially if it was all tied up in one stock and you sold all of it, the stock would plummet. So what your portfolio is worth at any given time really is a function of how you get out of it, is a function of your liquidation strategy. And how much money it cost to acquire the portfolio is a function of your acquisition strategy. So, and you see this all the time with corporate raiders when they sneakily buy up little by little by little until they have a certain percentage, I forget if it's 5 or 10, and they have to declare that they own part of the company. They want to do it hidden because their actions will affect the price of the company, well, for more reasons than just liquidity, but liquidity is certainly one. The second change we're going to have to make is that not all trading strategies, we're not going to allow all trading strategies. Now, this is... from a practical standpoint, this is completely reasonable, because for the normal mathematical model, you have to allow trading strategies that say buy at rational times and sell at irrational times. Okay? Now, many of us follow that strategy anyway, but I'm talking about the rational numbers and the irrational numbers, right? So, you know, any measurable hedging strategy has to be included in order to have, in the Brownian case, the completeness of markets, because you have to be able to perfectly replicate any contingent claim, and to do that you need a gigantic collection of possible hedging strategies, and, you know, they're totally ridiculous. In fact, even the Black-Scholes hedging strategy is physically impossible because it's continuous trading. Even if there were no transaction costs, how are you going to continuously trade? And if there are transaction costs, which there are, then your trading costs are infinite. So, can't do it. So it's not unreasonable from a practical standpoint to limit our trading strategies. We are going to limit them in a not really very limiting way. But what we want to have is a defined trade size. In order to have a defined trade size, we will limit our strategies to ones that are right continuous with left limits and have jumps, so that we always have a trading size. Now, generally, people believe that there's something like a supply curve underlying the market. So if you want to sell a stock, you say, you call up your broker and you say, you know, what is IBM selling for? And he says, well, it's selling for $35.28 a share right now. And you say, okay, well, put it in order to sell 100 shares if it goes up to $37. Okay, so that's a limit order. You know, you're limiting the amount and you're limiting the price. So, and he says, okay, how long do you want it? And you say, oh, let's keep it there for a week. So this is what you can do. And therefore, if somebody comes in and says, I want to buy 50,000 IBM shares or 100,000 or 300,000, and there's only 40,000 available to sell at that price, then the market maker will look at the higher prices and start adding them, throwing them in. Okay, well, I can only get 40,000 shares at $35.25, but if I go up to $35.35, I can get 60,000 shares, and if I go up, so you see that a large order then will force up the price. So there's a book, you know, that lists all the orders at all the limit prices, which is very hard to get your hands on. But that is the supply curve, okay? And so we assume, so our model will incorporate this supply curve. So our price is a function of time and the random variable, and then X is a real variable. A positive order means X is positive. Negative order means X is, a sell order means X is negative. Sorry, a buy order means X is positive. Sell is X is negative. And zero is like a marginal order, maybe 100 shares or less. And so, or zero, you don't do anything. And then what happens is that that what price you pay for the stock, if you're buying it, will depend on the size of your order. It will be and the higher, we will assume then that the higher the order size, the higher price you'll have to pay. So our assumptions on this supply curve will be that X is monotone. In other words, that if Y is a bigger order size than X, then this price that you'll have to pay will be less than the one for Y. Now, these are just technical assumptions so that we can do stochastic calculus. They have no economic meaning. And it's easy to see that this collection is not empty. You can easily construct artificial examples that show it's not empty. And so, yeah.
No.
I haven't mentioned the Markov property. So
this supply curve, like, if price depends on only this order, but it doesn't depend on previous orders.
Yeah. The price you pay depends on the size of your order. That's one factor. No, that's one of three factors. There's time, and there's the randomness. The randomness, since I haven't put any assumptions on S except that it's a good semi-martingale, so if you take X here to be ST0, then your price process up to this point can be anything, any semi-martingale. So it can easily be path-dependent, you know. You could even have it be a diffusion like this. This is a perfectly reasonable model, where you, from a theoretical standpoint, where you have your volatility coefficient depending on T and, thank you, Matsan, and XS, where, say, T minus epsilon is less than or equal to S, is less than or equal to T, so that you can have it on a little tranche of the past history. I mean, you probably don't want to go down to 1892 or something, right? Probably you just want the last, say, 40 years or less should be enough. Actually, there's a great book called A History of the New York Stock Exchange that was published in 1905. It's a beautiful book. It's really big, and it's on really thick paper. It has lots of woodcuts in it, and it has an article by John Dos Passos, and it's edited by a poet named E.C. Stedman. Amazing book. And plus, you can have a drift that's even more bizarre. You know, it can be anything, basically. So right now, this is DWT here, and then you can have a drift with the same sort of path dependence if you want. I don't care. So far, we have put no conditions on anything, except that we're adding a supply curve.
One more question. Maybe have two agents and put two orders simultaneously. Then you need to add two X's. X1 and X2 from two agents. And
well,
right depends on many agents.
Yeah, but these are easy to fudge, these problems, because, you know, time is sort of infinitely divisible. So I mean, what does it mean to have two orders simultaneously, right? You can't really have two orders simultaneously. I mean, you have an order like, in reality, you have an order what? At best, every 2 or 3 seconds, there's a trade, right? So simultaneously doesn't really happen.
That you could just lump them together. If you're really concerned that they could happen simultaneously, then you could just call them the same order.
So, you know, you have one guy who wants to sell at $62 100 shares, and another guy wants to sell at $62 1,000 shares, and they come exactly if they're different amounts, they want to sell at different prices, then you can separate them on the supply curve. But if they want to sell at the same price at the same time, you could just add them together. And say you have 1,100 shares at $62 at that time. Okay, so then a trading strategy usually is we have X, which is the number of risky asset, Y, which is the number of risk-free, and then that's normal. This is the amount of shares of stock we have. This is the amount of shares of money market we have. Now we have something new, which is a liquidation time, tau. So we are going to work on a finite horizon, 0 to capital T, and we are going to require all traders to liquidate their holdings before time capital T. Now, if that bothers you, you can use Professor Hull's solution and just decide that our finite fixed time capital T is what, the death of the sun? And by then, you know, who cares, right? I mean, besides that, you know, the United States has the longest running continual government in the world, which is what, a little over 200 years old? So, I mean, you know, just think 1,000 years in the future, right? Or 10,000 years in the future. They tell me now that in 10,000 years in the future, we will be able to eat fish caught in Lake Michigan with only small health risk. Assuming that there's no more pollution of Lake Michigan, which seems reasonable assumption. Okay, so that's the half-life of the PCBs that went in. Anyway, so we have these three things now, X, Y, and tau, all right? And we have our usual technical assumptions. So now what we want is a self-financing condition for our money market in terms of our risky asset holdings. This is the usual route we do, right? So we decide what strategy we're going to follow in buying and selling stock, and then whatever we have to do in the money market to make it self-financing, we do. So in other words, I want to buy some more stock, I don't have any money, I borrow some money, or I want to sell, I think stock's too risky, I want to put money in my savings account, wait until the market is about to take an upturn and get back in, then I do that. Okay, so let's consider what happens in the classical case first. Then that's just the classical case, which is assuming perfect liquidity. It's basically saying that the supply curve is constant, never changes for all X. That's the equivalent to the implicit, never spoken assumption of the standard model. There is no supply curve, it's constant. In that case, the value of the portfolio, since interest rates are 1, is just XT times the amount of shares plus the amount of money we have. And so therefore, in the classical case, the self-financing condition is usually taken, is simply this. There is no DRT because R is constant, so DRT is 0. And so this is the value of our portfolio is just the cumulative gains or losses against the stock price. Okay. So now we have to define a self-financing strategy with our new model. Okay, so the first thing we do is we assume that a self-financing strategy is CADLAG. Now, of course, I'm in Canada, so I don't have to apologize for French in Canada like I do in America, right? So CADLAG is continu à droite, limite à gauche, right, which is the French words for right continuous with left limits. Then the abbreviation in English is, of course, RCWLL, and the abbreviation in French is CADLAG. So it's pretty clear what the choice should be. At least in America it is. In England, they can't use a French acronym because it's French and they're still fighting the Hundred Years' War. I mean, no offense. But so the English call these paths SCORAHOD, which isn't an acronym at all. But in Canada, probably you can get away with CADLAG, right? Because after all, you know, right? Quebec, Montreal, that whole thing, right? So this, of course, is not pronounceable even in Polish. So that's why we use CADLAG. So we assume it's CADLAG, and we assume that this should be square summable, not square integrable. And so we assume that the jumps are square summable, which, you know, they would be if X were semi-Martingale, but we're not assuming that. And if the partial derivative of the supply curve at the marginal trade is zero, then that's all we have to assume. However, our empirical studies show this is never the case. So instead, we have to assume X is CADLAG with square summable. I really have to fix that. Jumps and a finite continuous quadratic variation process. Then what we get is that our self, now, there is a heuristic derivation for this, but it takes too long, so I'm skipping it. And so we get that our risk-free strategy is, now, normally, we would stop at this point here. And this would be, in the classical model, this would be our money market strategy for the, this means the left continuous version, if this is our hedging strategy for our risky asset or stock, okay? So this tells us exactly what we need to get a self-financing strategy. But because of the liquidity cost, we have two extra terms. This refers to our discrete trades, okay? So this delta XU, delta, of course, means a jump because delta is the Greek letter for D, and D is difference, I guess, but we call it a jump, so we really should use the Greek letter for J, but I don't know what the Greek letter for J is. I don't even know if the Greeks have a J. Do they have a J? You should know that, Tom. You stop at kappa? Okay. So, at any rate, so delta XU is the jump at of our trading strategy time U, the size of our trade, in other words, at time U. And so this quantity is the size of our trade times the price we had to pay to make this trade minus the price we would have had to pay had there been perfect liquidity. Okay? So this is our cost for this trade, for this one trade, due to liquidity. If X is positive, the jump is positive, that means that we bought the stock, then we forced up the price, and so this difference is positive, and we have a product of two positives, which is positive. If we sold, then delta X is negative, we forced down the price, so now this quantity is negative, and we have a product of two negatives, which is positive. So in any event, this quantity is positive, and we subtract it, or if you're from Quebec, we subtract it. And to get that, this is a cost that we have to subtract from our money market account in order to maintain the self-financing. Okay? Now, if we're trading continuously, which means we're always trading, constantly trading, but very, very tiny amounts, you know, marginal trades only, then the slope, it's a limiting procedure. So we get the slope of the supply curve at the marginal trade, and then the quadratic variation of the, well, we're only trading continuously, so we only have to worry about the continuous part of X.
So the quadratic variation of the continuous part of our training strategy comes in, because it's like the second term in the Taylor expansion. All right. In fact, that's how this is derived, is through a Taylor expansion argument. Okay, so this, then, are these two extra terms that come in our self-financing strategy, and that's basically what our liquidity cost is. So our liquidity cost, then, at time t, is simply the cumulative sum of the price we've had to pay because of the supply curve liquidity problems for our discrete trades plus our continuous trades, okay? Plus our initial liquidity cost to take an initial position. And this will, of course, be monotone increasing in t, since the slope is negative because x is increasing in x, and this is an increasing process. And we've already explained how this sum is, all the sum ends are non-negative. So this is an increasing process in t. And that's our liquidity cost over time. And then we notice three casual observations, that if we take a trading strategy of bounded variation, then, and this was more or less already observed by Francis Longstaff at UCLA, where he restricted trading strategies to bounded variation strategies, then the second term, any process X of bounded variation has zero continuous quadratic variation. Okay? So the second term in the liquidity costs is zero. That's good. That means if we want to reduce liquidity, we should follow bounded variation hedging strategies. Of course, any pure jump hedging strategy would be a bounded variation. And the second thing we notice is that when x is continuous, obviously the first term in liquidity has to be zero, because that just comes from our jumps, right? And there are no jumps. So if you combine these two observations, if you take a trading strategy that is continuous and a bounded variation, there's no liquidity cost at all, except the liquidity cost of your initial position. So if this were physically possible, this would be the ideal strategy to follow to eliminate liquidity costs, regardless of what the supply curve is. It's always to trade in very, very tiny amounts, never stopping. Well, you can stop, but when you stop, you have to just be zero. Okay, so then what we do is we do the usual theory, which is probably not that interesting for this audience. So I'll just skip over that and explain it heuristically. There are two fundamental theorems of finance, right? One is that no arbitrage, the Delbane-Shakhramer theory says that no arbitrage is essentially equivalent to the existence of a risk-neutral measure, or alternatively spoken, an equivalent martingale measure that that turns the process into a local martingale, or if there are jumps, a sigma martingale, which is slightly more general than a local martingale. Okay, so that's the first fundamental theorem of finance, and that holds in this context also. The second fundamental theorem of finance is that the market is complete, which means every contingent claim can be perfectly hedged, if and only if that risk-neutral or equivalent martingale measure is unique. Okay? Now, that can't possibly hold in this context, because since we're restricting our hedging strategies, there have to arise claims that can't be perfectly hedged. So if you're a mathematician, as many of you in the audience are, you know that when something is not true, you just change the requirements or the definitions, or you change, if there doesn't exist a solution to your partial differential equation, then you say, okay, let's call it a weak solution, and then we have one, right? So you just change what you want, okay? So a complete market is a very strong assumption. Everything has to be perfectly hedged. So we just change what we want, and we say that it's approximately complete if every contingent claim can be hedged up to epsilon. So choose your epsilon, however small. I can come up with one of our trading strategies that hedges it as close up to that epsilon accuracy. And then we have the second fundamental theorem, which is that the market is complete, approximately complete, if and only if the unique, the risk neutral measure is unique. So in essence, well, the French have a great term for this, which is moralement. So in English, I guess you would say morally, you know, the theorem is still true from a moral perspective. Morality is very big in the United States right now. I don't know if you've heard, but President Bush has just declared himself in favor of heterosexual marriage, exclusively. He's really going out on a limb there. Okay, actually, I don't know if, do you get Jon Stewart's The Daily Show? You do, yeah. He's Canadian? That explains it. I've always figured that, you know, behind that desk he's wearing shorts, right? And but at any rate, yeah, so what he said is the real reason that they want to outlaw gay marriage is so that Dick Cheney won't have to pay for his daughter's wedding. And okay, so at any rate, you'll still have to pay for her civil union, though, right? Okay, so now, whenever you give a finance talk, you can't really expect to get away and out the door without saying, what does this mean for Black Scholes? Right? You always have to do that. So what does this mean for Black Scholes? Well, so we have a very, very, very simple model, okay? But, you know, yours was simple too, right? I mean, you know, okay. So, copulas are simple. They have a great name, but they're simple. Okay, so we're going to also take a very simple model. Now, of course, this function, since it's a price, is always strictly positive, and we know that anything strictly positive can be represented as e to the log, right? So this is e to some function g. And of course, st0, the price with perfect liquidity, or the price at a marginal trade, you can take either interpretation, is also strictly positive, so we can just factor that out. So we can write stx in this way. Now we make, since this is economics, we make simplifying assumptions, which is we drop the dependence on t and we drop the dependence on omega. And this gives us just e to the g of x. This is what I love about applied math. Okay, and now, next we assume g is smooth, because after all, why not? And then we expand it into Taylor series, which we can do because it's smooth. And so we get our usual Taylor series expansion. And then, in a gesture towards biology, we just truncate it after the first term and assume it's affine. Okay, you know, because why not? Because the error is small, you know, after, you know, we don't know what it is anyway, so we might as well just throw away all the terms after the first two. So now we have it affine, and alpha naught's a constant, e to the alpha naught's a constant, so that can be folded into, that's just multiplying this, so we just, you know, up to a constant, this we can change it, put it in, fold it into this term. And so now we have our price process is e to the alpha x times st0. So this is, I don't know, we're making a few assumptions, okay? We're assuming it's a fairly simple situation, but this reduces it to statistical techniques that I can actually do, which is estimating one parameter. This I can do. You know, taking data and estimating functions, that's hard. But estimating a parameter is easy. We can teach it to undergraduates, as long as we don't test them on it. And then, as long as we're making simplifying assumptions, we might as well assume it's Brownian, you know, Black Scholes, geometric Brownian motion, right? So we make a few assumptions, but, you know, it's okay. We're not saying this is all we're going to do. This is just to see what happens, you know? And it's quite interesting what happens. Okay, so let's look at an option. You know, a European, American are much too hard for me. So we just do European call options. And I was very relieved to find that their actual European options are important, right? I mean, the options on indexes are European options, even in New York. Okay, so they're old Europe-type options, but that's okay. So at any rate, we have our calls and our puts and all this stuff, the usual crap. And let's suppose that we do the Black-Scholes formula. Okay, then we get this, which is, you know, the usual Black-Scholes hedging strategy.
Okay? And the Black-Scholes hedging strategy is a continuous strategy, but it is definitely not a bounded variation. And so it has infinite variation because it's a, you know, it's the partial derivative of a solution of a PDE composed with the Brownian motion. So it inherits the Brownian motion behavior in the hedging strategy and therefore has a quadratic variation, which is non-trivial. And so we end up calculating exactly then. There's no jumps because it's a continuous trading strategy, but we get the quadratic variation term coming in the liquidity costs. Okay, and this then is the, at time zero, this is the amount of liquidity cost you're going to pay following the strategy up to time t. And this integral is finite, but it's actually quite big. It's computed under the risk-neutral measure. But this is a fairly large value of the integral. But, you know, we can smooth it using a standard, you know, pretty, you know, the first smoothing technique you think of. Actually, the first smoothing technique you think of is t to t plus 1 over n. But that's not adapted. So we use the smoothing strategy of t minus 1 over n to t. And somebody's going to say, what if t is less than 1 over n? But then you do the obvious modification, okay? So that's our smoothing strategy. And now it's continuous end of bounded variation, so there's no liquidity costs. And so you can, if you're clever, and you can approximate the Black-Scholes strategy with a smooth strategy, instead of having very large liquidity costs, you can have zero. All right, so then the next step is to estimate, when do I stop? 7:05? That's my 50-minute, yeah. All right, well, I could go into hyperspeed, but. All right, so we'll estimate the supply curve, right? So then you want to, okay, so what is this supply curve, this mysterious supply curve? We've said it's e to the alpha x, but let's actually get data and see what it looks like. That was our idea. But we're going to assume it's e to the alpha x for this talk. I now have an unfortunate PhD student who is not assuming it's e to the alpha x and doing spline estimation. We got this book data, so it was. But at any rate, for this talk, it'll be e to the alpha x, so we want to estimate what alpha is with data. So we use the TAC database. We use the Lee-and-Reddy algorithm. Which is, you know, to decide whether it's a, because this data is not kept. They don't keep the data about whether a trade is buyer initiated or sell initiated. So you can't get that. Well, maybe you can get it for love. I haven't tried that approach, but you can't get it for money. Okay. So anyway, we did it on these five stocks with, because they have traded at options, and these were, you know, these are five stocks of differing liquidities. And they were really great because during the period we were looking at, month of May, nothing happened. Okay, there's no dividend, there's no ex-dividend, there's no merger, there's no stock split, there's no nothing. Absolutely nothing happened for an entire month for these five stocks with traded options. So you know, we don't have to control for anything. And then we estimate alpha, which is really trivial. I mean, we don't know what ST0 is, but that's okay. We divide and it drops out, and we just get this. So we could just look at two different prices of two different sizes, and we can estimate alpha. So doing that, we got that with these sample sizes. We got the mean is very small here. The mean estimate for alpha, this is four zeros and then a 6-7. For American Airlines. For MGM, it was four zeros and then a 9. For Philip Morris, it was four zeros and a 7. So these are big stocks, very liquid. For Reebok, it was three zeros, aha, and then a 13. So that's twice as big an alpha as American Airlines. And Toys R Us is three zeros and then a 12. So, you might notice that the standard deviation is very large relative to the mean, which means that these estimates are highly inaccurate, which is an indication that the model is crappy, but I mean that it's more complicated than just e to the alpha x. But assuming it is e to the alpha x, and
and I will assume it is to the alpha x. What we got was that we got that option prices with these values of alpha for these five companies, the component of the price due to liquidity cost range from 2 to 5%, which is kind of large. And then the last part of my talk, which I will now skip, so I have 1 minute, so I'll summarize it in a minute because it's easy to summarize, is we decided to don't turn on all the lights, I'll go blind, just some. We decided to compare how the cost due to inaccurate hedging, rebalancing, you know, so basically, I guess traders use the Black-Scholes market, you know, and they estimate the Black-Scholes paradigm, and they estimate sigma, but they know it's wrong, right? So they estimate sigma frequently, and then they follow the Black-Scholes hedging strategy, changing sigma every time. So this isn't a big deal. This can be, I think Steve Shreve and Nicole Al-Karoui wrote a paper showing that this it's not a big deal to do to correct for this. But at any rate, the question then becomes, how often do you rebalance versus the liquidity cost? Because every time you rebalance, which means make a trade, you pay a liquidity cost. If you don't rebalance, you pay a cost because your trading strategy is less accurate. So which is the bigger cost here? Should you rebalance more frequently and get a better, more accurate approximation of the correct trade hedging strategy, or but pay a higher liquidity cost, or should you take the sacrifice of a worse approximation of your hedging strategy and a lower liquidity cost? And it turns out that the liquidity cost is a much higher factor than the inaccuracy due to your hedging strategy. So you're better off with less frequent hedging. Of course, it depends on what the supply curve actually is. But for most supply curves, the liquidity, you're better off with less frequent hedging if the liquidity is at all a problem in terms of the eventual cost you pay to replicate your option. And of course, this can all be quantified. That's what all this is. Okay.